Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the editors of the magazine that once got Ronald Reagan to say that libertarianism is the heart and soul of conservatism gather each Monday to talk about the news. I am Matt Welch, joined by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and a triumphantly returning Catherine Mangu Ward. Hi, friends.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Super happy, Suderman. We're going to jump back into our conversation from last week about the intersection of cops, guns, trials, violence, protests, and riots. But first, on October 2nd, 2018, Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. He was never seen alive again. At a time when America is focused on its own domestic crises, there is one movie reminding us that there are unbelievable and shocking events unfolding across the globe. The new documentary, The Dissident, boldly looks into the details and intrigue surrounding the murder that shocked the world. The movie not only unearths new proof, it ultimately exposes Khashoggi's killers. Senator Rand Paul has stated, "The evidence is overwhelming that the Crown Prince was involved." Senator Lindsey Graham says, "There's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw." The Associated Press calls The Dissident a real-life thriller playing out at the highest levels of power and wealth. Can you handle the truth, Catherine? From the Academy Award-winning director of Icarus comes The Dissident, now playing at home on demand. Visit thedissident.com for more information. That's thedissident.com. Watch it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, this is shaping up to be quite the fraught week on the streets of our big cities here in the United States and America, as closing arguments are expected today, Monday, in the trial of Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the killing of George Floyd last May, an incident that touched off nationwide protests, riots in some cases, looting in some cases, and what has been billed kind of as a racial reckoning across America's cultural institutions. This past weekend alone, there were protests and clashes with cops in several cities, including Oakland, Washington, D.C., Portland, Oregon, big surprise there, and also Chicago, where a 13-year-old kid was fatally shot by police last week. The Minnesota Twins Baseball Club has preemptively canceled their games later this week in an expectation of possible violence. The Minneapolis public schools, which have been closed for a long time, just recently reopened. They're going to go back to remote learning, et cetera. Catherine, since you were a game time scratch last week and missed our discussion with Keith Olbermann's friend Robbie Suave about some of these events, I wanted you to drill down to one particular conundrum that I frequently hear in my cop adjacent world. Many libertarians believe some version of the formulation that an armed society is a polite society. And also, many libertarians also become libertarians because they're outraged over the police use of force. Is there a contradiction there? Doesn't the fact of America's comparative armedness, gun owningness, make police much more likely to treat interactions with the populace as potential dangers and therefore kind of escalate the whole
violence-y thing? Is that what we're calling it? We should get a tag on the website for that. Yeah.
That's term of art.
So
term of art.
I would say in a vacuum, that's a good point and a real contrast. But in the actual world that we actually live in, it's not. And here's why. First of all, we are a heavily armed country in comparison with other similar nations. And that's just a baseline that we're operating with. Like, even if it is true that an armed citizenry makes the specific job of being a police officer more dangerous, okay, it's a more dangerous job, because to disarm the population or to attempt to do so would make the job of being a police officer really dangerous. It would make it, to be in charge of enforcing laws to take away guns would be a disaster on a scale that we have never seen in this country. And I say that understanding the disaster that we have seen in the last year. So I think there is sort of a baseline here, which is like, yeah, maybe it makes a lot of things more dangerous in this country, actually. But the guns are already there, and our right to own them is written into our founding documents. And so There it is. That's a baseline we operate with. I would say, though, if we were thinking about a condition we could change that would make it safer to be a police officer, then that we dive right into the question of overcriminalization. And, you know, that is so acutely at stake in so many of these cases this week and every week. The fact that people are getting into violent confrontations with police officers over crimes that are not crimes in so many cases, crimes that have no victims, crimes that shouldn't be crimes. That to me is just like a clear beacon toward the answer. If we're worried about police officer safety, and I will say here, being a police officer is not the most dangerous job in America. You know, a lot of people, I think, have been quick in the last few weeks to note that, in fact, the number of actual killings of African Americans by police officers is lower than people think. If you look at polls, people think that those killings are very, very common. They are actually, luckily, still quite rare, relatively speaking. But likewise, people think that it's incredibly dangerous to be a cop, and they're wrong about that, too. There are a lot of other more dangerous jobs. If we want to change one of the baseline conditions, though, about danger to police officers, we should think about, and I hate to be the libertarian cliche, but here I am doing it, ending the war on drugs and other similar victimless crimes should be removed from the ledger of things that cops can shoot people for doing.
Speaking of libertarian cliches, a question for Nick Gillespie.
Thank you, Matt Welch. That joke is itself a cliche, so we're now in an infinite regress.
Yes. This could be a lot of time for infinite regress towards the end of this
Matt, did you,
podcast.
I mean, if I'm not mistaken, you spent some time in Prague, didn't you?
Thank you.
Busking.
Thank you. I feel like that hasn't received enough attention. We're going to see a lot of protests this week, regardless of what happens. I think that is, and we're seeing them already.
Well, if Maxine Waters gets her way, certainly the congresswoman who was calling for mass riots unless Derek Chauvin is found guilty of murder.
Not sure that's the most responsible thing, but maybe you can explicate that further.
Marketplace of ideas, Matt. We believe in that.
So at these demonstrations, we are certain to see a couple of things, Nick. One of them is the abbreviation ACAB, which is short, not for a Genesis album in the mid-70s, but for All Cops Are Bastards. And we also will see signs and calls to defund the police, which in Minneapolis was actually, unlike in most places, was a live thing there for a while. Should we cheer at such signs? What is a libertarian to make? What is to be done, Nick Gillespie, about that type of sloganeering as we think about ways to improve?
Well, you know, building off of something Catherine was talking about, you know, there needs to be a radical shift in the way that the police interact with people. And on a certain, you know, there's at least a couple of things to consider. But if the police are enforcing traffic laws, if the police are using the pretext of, you know, of street minor street offenses related to the war on drugs in order to stop people and interact, I mean, all of the studies show that the main generator of police violence is the number of interactions you have with the police. You know, blacks in any given moment are not more likely necessarily in any given stop to have an interaction result in violence, but they actually have, you know, particularly black men have more interactions with cops during the course of the year than, say, the equivalent aged white kid. Part of that is because of things like the war on drugs and whatnot and the way that we criminalize certain types of activity. You want to minimize those kinds of confrontations, and you'll have fewer problems with that. So, you know, that's like a big starting point. The idea of defunding the police is kind of stupid and incoherent, I think, in the sense of, like, if you're just going to say, okay, we're just getting rid of cops and we're bringing in social workers, or we're just going to get rid of, you know, we're going to get rid of police and not do anything in response. These are not smart moves. They're not well considered. The other thing is that, you know, we need to keep all of this stuff in perspective, whether it's mass shootings or spree shootings or the number of people who are being killed by the cops every year, because this is also something where, you know, one of the things that reason does is it applies a analytical frame to stuff The number of people who are killed by the cops every year, particularly unarmed people of whatever, you know, race, ethnicity, gender, it is not going up. And we're not talking about large numbers. In 2019, there were about 1,000 people killed by the police in confrontations. You know, fewer than 100 of those were killed, were unarmed, or where there was not some kind of violence, like some kind of weapon introduced by the person. You know, we need to understand that, you know, the proximate cause of a lot of discussions about larger issues oftentimes is just it's kind of a media hysteria. And that, you know, that's worth talking about, because we need to have conversations about things like, you know, the war on drugs, about schools, about economic opportunity. And if we only do that through the lens of police violence, we're going to have really bad conversations that don't get at any of the major problems that we really need to be dealing with that are going to affect hundreds of thousands or millions of people, as opposed to, you know, dozens or hundreds.
I think that those numbers are an important contextual point. I would add only that compared to most other countries, which don't have as many guns lying around as we do and don't have perhaps a history of violence as much as we
but,
do.
But going back to your starting point about the number of guns, there are a couple of things to keep in mind. One is that, you know, we had a mass buy-up of guns and got, you know, people have, more and more guns are in circulation and have been for the past 25 years. For almost all of those years, violent crime and crimes committed with guns has been declining. We've seen a brief uptick over the past year, which is obviously atypical. We need to see whether or not we're in a new trend going upwards or not. But, you know, we know that guns in circulation does not necessarily mean more violence or necessarily even more violence, you know, between citizens and the police. Just one other thing that I'll throw out there is, you know, and this is an interesting shift, is that the percentage of households who report owning guns is shrinking even as the number of guns is going up. So it may be that it's different if 25% of households have many, many more guns than 50% or 60% of households having relatively fewer guns. It might be that the concentration matters.
Peter, we're heading into a weekend and perhaps a whole season here as things open up and spring has sprung and even Peter Suderman leaves his house. There's going to be a lot of...
That's a rumor and I will not confirm it.
There's going to be a lot of talk about rules of engagement, about freedom of assembly and protests and whatnot. As such, I want you to sit down, close your eyes, and try to identify the problems with the following chain of events that happened late last week. Ready? A judge in Minnesota last week issued a temporary order barring the Minnesota State Patrol from using physical force or tear gas against journalists. In response, cops near the Brooklyn Center demonstrations, which have sprung up after a police woman shot her weapon or firearm instead of a taser and killed Dante Wright at a traffic stop. Police there rounded up journalists, put them on their stomachs, took pictures of their faces and their press credentials before releasing them. What were the errors in this string of actions, Peter Suderman, according to you?
Well, it seems like it starts with a police officer who accidentally, who claims to have accidentally pulled an actual pistol rather than a taser out of her belt and then killed someone as a result, right? And so whether that was a genuine accident or something else, it was certainly an error, a massive and deadly error. And if that hadn't happened, we probably would not be in exactly this position. And then, you know, it's really disturbing to hear these stories where you have to have a judge intervene to say, hey, don't use tear gas against journalists who are covering protests against state violence, right? And then, of course, the judge has to, like, list out all the different things that you can't do to journalists, and the police are just like, well, but you didn't say we couldn't tie them up like hogs and take photos of them. I mean, it's just, it's not a great situation. I think I would actually sort of add to the points that Catherine and Nick made here about overcriminalization. A little bit in this context, right? You're talking about people going out and sort of being involved in some protest-like activities. I think peaceful protests are quite good. There's, you know, been questions about whether or not people need to wear masks, you know, in these gatherings. And I think that we need to be having the conversation about overcriminalization in the context of COVID restrictions, because the real problem in terms of having a very large number of interactions between the police and the public, which of course generates more conflict, more violence between the police and the public, is that when you have extremely small, kind of minor personal behaviors regulated so heavily, right, then you just have it. Then what that means is that police always have an excuse to stop you if they want, right? And that is what the COVID restrictions are all about. It is about, it is almost entirely about kind of small ball personal behaviors. And, you know, and the rules that have been put in place, in some cases you can, I think, especially last year pre-vaccine, you can argue that there was a case for them. But now in a world with multiple quite effective vaccines, where we are approaching 50% of the country has had access to a first dose. And as we know, within about 2 weeks of the first dose, you have most of your immunity conferred upon you. You know, we really need to be talking about getting rid of all of these rules as soon as possible. And instead, We have a sort of left liberal establishment that is going in the opposite direction, that wants to keep this stuff in place permanently. You have, you know, in Michigan, they're just talking about making all the emergency measures, including a bunch of the social distancing and mask wearing stuff for businesses permanent. And we're going to see, I think, a push for what is effectively a TSA for virus prevention that will be the TSA, but for every part of your life. We're talking about the total bureaucratization of daily life and of human interaction. And that is just a recipe for a huge amount of police-public interaction that, in some small but non-trivial percentage of cases, is going to result in police violence that's totally unjustified, because that is what's that is what always happens when you have legal regimes that attempt to control, you know, the exact size of the dice or air fresheners you can hang from the mirror of your car, and treat that as an offense that police need to be investigating, and wasting people's time, you know, pulling them over, patting them down, because of. And it's very disturbing, kind of the world we're entering into right now.
Catherine, let's extend one of Peter's points and one of Nick's points. Peter's about COVID, Nick's about press coverage. There was a study a couple of weeks back. I forget exactly who did it, but it seemed convincing. New study proves it. But looking at American news coverage of COVID and the percentage of coverage that was like super duper negative compared to positive. Granted, it's not a super positive story, but sometimes trends do go in a positive direction. And it compared that tenor of coverage with that of other countries, and found that America was like by far the most negative. Like 90% of all stories were negative. Like, it's easy in a big country to say, "See that person? They took the vaccine and got sick. Can you believe it?" Those types of stories. And I wonder if a similar thing happens in the way that we cover interactions between police and deadly incidents between police and citizens. There was a piece in the New York Times, I believe, over the weekend. Headline was, "Throughout trial over George Floyd's death, killings by police mount." Mount's a good word there. Since testimony in Derek Chauvin's trial began on March 29th, more than three people a day have died at the hands of law enforcement. And there wasn't a whole lot of like context thrown into those numbers over time. It's just like, people keep dying and half of them are black and brown. See, Is there something to be said about a similarity of kind of negativity and pessimism about the way these things are covered? Or is that just, the reality of the fallen world that we live in?
I'm going to take door number two, reality of the fallen world that we live in. I think it seems that from that one study, which shows, because studies show, that the American media seems to be more negative. And I think that's an interesting cultural difference. Like, that's worth kind of digging into a little bit. But, both in the case of COVID and in the case of police violence, there's stuff that we could do about it. And so I think that the more charitable spin is not just like people are doom mongering for the sake of doom mongering and people like to be negative, but to say, hey, actually, countries where the press is overwhelmingly positive tend to be countries where the press is not free. Don't worry. Everything is all, everything is in order, citizens, like nothing to see here. So I am at least somewhat inclined to take the negativity of our press as a sign of its independence and health, even if collectively the press gets things wrong, misjudges the scale of various problems all the time. Of course that's true. If I were to rank order,
I once heard a great anecdote from a journalist who went on one of these China junkets, and of course they were presented to by bureaucrats all day long, and they would just like spend the whole time, the American journalists who were there would just ask questions that were obviously really critical, and then in the discussion groups afterwards would just be like, these bureaucrats, they're telling us lies, and what about this and this, and like they're exaggerating. And the bureaucrats and like the minders from the Communist Party were really upset about this, and they were like, would you talk this way about your own country? And they're like, oh yeah, that's what we do. That's our whole job.
Well, and I will say, the place where the American press actually has historically been insufficiently critical, where they have done the thing that the Chinese minders expected the press to do, is with respect to the police. I mean, the sort of rerunning of police blotters as truth is a real plague on especially local news. And if that's changed to be more negative, like, I think that might actually be good. I will say the one thing, Matt, that you mentioned earlier that I worry about, that I think is new, is this dynamic where we have a bunch of negative coverage, including a bunch of negative coverage about how maybe people are going to riot. And now the state has all these new powers that it has assumed in the last year, including lockdowns and school shutdowns. And so we go ahead and preemptively do those because we're scared because of the aggressively negative coverage, which predicts a broader social response, which in turn does stuff like create weirdly empty, deserted streets where people do lots of car theft, and also creates, as Peter mentioned, more opportunities for newly criminalized behavior, more opportunities for bad interactions between police and citizens. And so the cycle repeats. That thing does worry me. I do not like the preemptive closing of schools because maybe there's going to be nighttime violence in the streets, because anyway, y'all figured out how to do homeschooling while you have jobs anyway, right? It's fine. Like that right there, don't like that. Don't like that dynamic. And the same with the shuttering of businesses.
There should be, there can be maybe a kind of a slippery slope analysis on some of this, because I think it done slid. I'm thinking in terms of
is it the slope that slides, or is it you?
Exactly. It's Bill de Blasio in most cases. No, I remember some kind of snow. I don't know if it was Hurricane Sandy or some snowmageddon, local
superstorm Sandy, Matt. Let's be accurate.
Thank you very much for that corrective. That de Blasio ordered the shutdown of the subway for the first time like in a century. And people are like, wow, we've shut down the subway. Can you believe that? And then, of course, during COVID, since it's been really important to wipe down surfaces, as we've known is not true since last April, they've been shutting the subway every night for 2 hours. Actually, it was longer for a while, like 4 hours. But now it's 2 hours every night to wipe down surfaces, clean it up. And like, how many things are like that throughout, to Catherine's point of just we've taken this. And Nick and I were actually talking about this before we hit the record button earlier, like the stuff that we have sadly gotten used to now without kind of conscious identification of it and pushback against it might just stay with us. Nick, I'm going to invite you to muse further on that subject.
Well, on the topic of the press, like, don't expect the press to be consistent and to actually interrogate power, because, you know, I didn't see a lot of critical coverage or consistent coverage of the way people acted during COVID. And so you go from, you know, one week where there's a handful of idiots, marching on the Michigan State Capitol, and that's a super spreader event. And then the next week, there's 20,000 people in a Brooklyn park who are, you know, jostling cheek to cheek. That's not a super spreader event. And that's a spontaneous, wonderful, kind of illustration of freedom and of people really demanding the rights. And you have epidemiologists who are working to explain why one is a bad thing, the other isn't. Again, you have the press. I mean, I do think it's really important to, you know, recognize that whatever story the press wants to tell itself or we want to tell ourselves, as often as not in the United States, you know, perhaps not, quite as directly, but we're also a handmaiden to power. Where are the seriously critical, kind of analyses from places like the New York Times of things like stimulus spending or COVID relief that has nothing to do with any of that kind of stuff? Like, you don't get a lot of that. And I think that's one of the things that we can help bring to all of this is just to, you know, keep in mind, and you can have like all of these things can be true, which is that cops should be held to a higher standard of behavior than people. Like, I'm totally getting sick of the idea, you know, and we've seen this in the wake of the Daunte Wright killing. This happens where cops, you know, they reach for a gun, but it's a taser and this and that. And it's like somehow that explains it or it justifies it. And it's like cops have to be held to higher standards when they act poorly or when they shoot at the wrong time in a high stress situation. And all I'm seeing now from a lot of different places is like, oh, well, you know, you be in that stress situation and I bet you would shoot somebody for the wrong reason. It's like, no, yeah, that's
why I'm not a cop.
Yeah. And that's like why they get trained and that's why they get paid and that's why they retire younger, at full benefits and all of this kind of stuff. That's one thing. But then the other thing, too, is that to pretend that there is a rising epidemic of, you know, cops hunting people, particularly black kids, for no good reason. Those cops actually, you know, I mean, why were they running, you know, after a couple of people in Chicago at 2:40 a.m.? You know, well, like we need to be able to keep all of these things constant and have serious discussions about, you know, when people in authority go wrong. And I think that's a bigger deal than when individuals fail to live up to their responsibilities to be decent people or good citizens or something like that. And then the press, you know, to go back to this just scenario of cops tying up journalists and whatnot. Part of me is like, you know, the worst thing that, why should you ever have to show a press credential? There's nothing in the Constitution that says that certain journalists or certain people who have credentials are journalists and they get special privileges, and they shouldn't. You know, at a protest, if you are engaging in violent behavior, the cops should rein you in, and if you're not, they need to leave you alone, and that's it. And it doesn't matter if you're a journalist or you're a citizen or whatever. Everybody's got a goddamn cell phone. Everybody's a journalist. Right. And everybody under the First Amendment has a right of assembly and things like that. So I think we're constantly folding into these weird tribal, kind of arguments about stuff that shift minute by minute, topic by topic. And, I think we just need to hold police and authority at a higher standards. But then we also have to make sure that the media is not selling us a bunch of crap.
So you're which against, they do on a regular basis. You're against having
pretty much everything.
Yeah, a vaccine passport system that also has your press
my
credential.
My vaccine
in
passport
it.
Is my press credential.
You know
baby.
What? Press credentials are bad, bad things, man. Press credentials that, you know, this country, these colonies were founded on a refutation of a licensed press, of a regulated press. I think they got that right.
Let's I mean, I just think that all of our press cards and our vaccine passport, vaccine cards should be done through the blockchain on NFTs, right? Should just have a unique identifier.
And then if we could ideally get chips embedded somewhere, but you know, I guess we all have with our vaccines, we got those chips put in so we can use those from now on.
Those of us who have taken the vaccine, Catherine. We're going to pivot to a different type of law enforcement that related to the border of the United States, the borders of the United States, here in a moment. But first, are troubles weighing you down, preventing you from experiencing happiness or achieving your goals? Let's get you to start living a happier life beginning today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable and get instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 57 states. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what I have not been receiving from Twitter support ever since my account got hacked 1 week ago, has helped more than 1 million people take charge of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. BetterHelp.com is more affordable than traditional online counseling services. Financial aid is additionally available, and soon, hopefully, that depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, whatever, will be behind you. Go to the website, betterhelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and desires, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okie dokie. So Friday, incredible news dump, bizarre news dump, and then, you know, sort of modified in the face of criticism that the Biden administration came out with, despite its many, many pledges to the contrary on the campaign trail. And even in the early days of the administration, the White House announced that it was maintaining the Donald Trump era refugee target for fiscal year 2021 at the all-time low of 15,000 refugees to be taken in during that year. The quote at the time was, "It remains justified by humanitarian concerns and is otherwise in the national interest," unquote. Cue lots of outrage from Democrats and humanitarian institution, libertarians too. And then a couple hours later, Jen Psaki issued up a press release saying that there'd been some confusion. There was confusion over the thing we said 2 hours ago, and that President Biden would be issuing a final increased refugee cap for the fiscal year beginning for the remainder of the fiscal year 2021 by May 15th. Catherine, in the run-up to the Friday debacle here, there was plenty of reporting about how the administration was saying that, you know, increasing the refugee cap would be bad optics given what's going down at the border. Can you explain in your patient voice how the refugee cap and what's happening at the border are not right. the same
so
thing?
There's just so much stupid here. I don't know if I can use my patient voice. I'm going to try. But there's a bunch of ways that people can come into the United States. They have an obscenely complicated system for sorting various would-be emigres into these categories and dealing with them depending on what their ports of arrival or modes of arrival are. And the refugee cap lifting the refugee cap, to my mind, should be the least difficult thing to do. We are talking about a group of people that have a strong claim to come here under one of our sort of stated categories of immigrants that we allow, which is people who are, people who are seeking refuge, people who are here because of what they fear for their fate at home. And I think that there is, you know, the fact that they're sort of saying the quiet part loud with the optics stuff really is infuriating to me. The idea that they're like, wow, yeah, so we've screwed up immigration in a bunch of different ways, so we're going to screw up this one too because we think, like, overall it might make us look less bad. A, no, it didn't. They were wrong. And B, that's not a good reason. We have a system built on a whole bunch of different caps. I think all those caps should be higher. I think every single one of those numbers should be much, much larger. And Biden campaigned on that idea as well. Biden was very clear on the stump over and over that he was going to reverse the various policy moves that the Donald Trump administration did to restrict immigration to this country, especially for these categories where people do have a much more legitimate claim to come here. And then he was just like, no, just kidding, I'm not going to. And I think that he absolutely deserved to be called out for that from all quarters. I'm glad that they reversed. I'm not glad that they didn't admit the mistake. The sort of like, oh, you dummies, you misunderstood what I was saying. Like, we've all debated that guy in a dorm room and he sucks. Like, don't don't gaslight the entire American press corps into being like, maybe you weren't listening carefully. No, they were listening really, really carefully. And you just said the wrong bad thing. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean,
the Biden administration is like wizards, right? Except instead of always being on time, they just always say exactly
correct.
What they mean to.
They,
and if there's a problem, if anybody misunderstands that, it's somebody else's problem and
correct.
Not theirs.
Yeah. So I think that it was both an immoral and a unpopular decision. And I wish they hadn't done it. I'm glad they lightly reversed it. There is still so much more work to do.
Nick, I mentioned Ronald Reagan at the top of this podcast. He, like his predecessor, Jimmy Carter, placed an absolute premium on America welcoming refugees. We welcomed something like 1 out of 70 refugees in the world back then. And there were quite a lot of refugees from the communist bloc, from Cuba, from Vietnam, et cetera, Iran as well. One of his quotes was, the United States has a responsibility of welcoming and resettling those who flee oppression. We have now, thanks to Trump, the coronavirus, and now Biden, we are resettling something like 1 in 1,000 of the world's refugees, at a time where over the past decade, the global population of refugees has nearly doubled to an all-time high. Can you wax poetical about America's role and why it's important to be the place that welcomes people who flee from oppression?
Yeah, I actually can't wax eloquent because this is, I mean, it's enraging. And, you know, part of the difference, and it's good to remember Carter and Reagan kind of as having a lot of continuity, but you know, that was also the Cold War, and one of the best cards that the United States could play in the Cold War was that we were the place where people wanted to go or were coming to go, and we were willing to take people in because we had faith in our institutions and we had faith in our kind of moral obligations. That has all gone missing for a long time, and it's not simply to keep up with the idea of continuity. It's not just Biden and Trump, but it's also Obama and Bush. We have spent, as a country, we have spent the 21st century destabilizing vast parts of the world. And, you know, the United States is not responsible for all of the problems in the world. But when you look at places like the Middle East, and particularly the destabilization of Syria, like, it's not an accident. You know, it's not an accident that we were in Iraq for no good goddamn reason and destroyed that country, allowed Iran to become the sole regional power. We blundered into, Barack Obama improvised us into Syria in a way that has extended, you know, a conflict there. And again, we're not responsible for all of the ills of the world, but in very particular places, we have either created or massively exacerbated all of the problems. And then to shut our borders, it's just, you know, it's depressing, it's humiliating, it is frustrating as hell. And then just to go back to the press question, it's like, you know, what kind of idiot people in the press are surprised that Biden is terrible on immigration in many ways, or is indecisive, or just doesn't have any idea what day of the week it is? Of course. So this is the type of thing where, you know, we need better leadership. And hopefully, you know, we can hold them accountable through elections. But, you know, sadly, we know what's coming in 2022 is that Biden is going to do a bunch of this kind of stuff. The stimulus spending will have played out. And he'll be replaced by a bunch of equally terrible idiots from the right who will take over. I mean, I think the Republicans will take the House, and then they'll institute a bunch of stupid things. And then, you know, it's going to go back and forth. But it's deeply, deeply disturbing.
Can we talk about George W. Bush, like, popping up this week to be like, hey, by the way, immigration is good? I think that's an interesting little subplot we've got going. So he has an exhibit that opened this week in Dallas of his paintings of immigrants. And he made a little news this week for basically saying, hey, one of my biggest regrets of my presidency is that I didn't immigration reform done, that I didn't make more headway in that problem. And I think it's interesting because of what you just said, Nick, that like it is a failure of leadership. Like the fact that we, that everyone seems to just enjoy slamming, you know, slamming their heads into the wall over and over on this immigration issue instead of trying to find common ground, because there are a lot of moving pieces.
I wouldn't say everyone enjoys it.
There are a lot of moving pieces. Like there are a bunch of like tokens that people could be trading, right? Like there's extra security at the border, which I think is misguided, but is like a thing Republicans desperately want that could be traded for higher caps for legal immigration. There are refugees who already meet requirements and are seeking entry from outside. There are asylees who are already here. There's the DACA people. There's economic migrants. There's, you know, there's just so many trade-offs that you could make to rationalize and expand immigration. And I think George Bush saying, like, I saw all those and I kind of had them in front of me, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't get it over the finish line. And like, I'm bummed about that. And the fact that there's all these headlines this week that are like, George Bush suddenly a progressive. And it's like, no, he was very clear about wanting to do that all along. It's not a progressive value to open borders. It's a thing lots of people want. They just want to do it differently and they can't sort it out.
There's, I mean, two things. One is there's no question. I mean, the Democratic Party is terrible on immigration. The Republican Party is terrible on immigration, and their rhetoric is awful on immigration. And George Bush, it's almost, you know, you start to think like, oh, maybe he wasn't that bad. And it's like, actually, he was. And in 2004,
he created a lot of refugees and asylum seekers, for sure.
Yeah, and after he... After he won in 2004, he said, you know, I have a lot of political capital, which he did. He owned the entire government, and he was going to prioritize getting some kind of comprehensive immigration reform. And it took about 2 weeks for the Republican Party and some Democrats to be like, no, you're not. And he gave up. Same thing with Social Security reform. You know, we forget at our peril how terrible a president George W. Bush was. You know, like he seems to be a nice guy, but it's also like, thanks for nothing. You know, really, thanks for nothing. He had the moment for that once every 25 years, once every 30 years immigration reform. He had the capital and he chose to fritter it away on like a terrible second term that did really nothing.
I think in fairness to that, the Social Security one was particularly stillborn after the 2004 election. Immigration reform, there's a longer period of gestation there with John McCain and Ted Kennedy hashing it out in 2006 and gang of this and gangs of that.
McCain, not to speak ill of the dead, but he also, you know, he didn't have, for a guy who was like, oh, I'm really into immigration, he caved on that.
Well, I mean, that's the vicissitudes. I don't even know what that means, but it's a great word, of running for president. He actually, that was a key reason why that failed, because he wanted to get the nomination in 2008. He knew he had to get his name off, and that almost sunk his candidacy from the beginning. So he lateraled the job of being Teddy Kennedy's helpmate on immigration reform to John Kyle, and then started opposing the various bits that he had long
built the damn wall.
Build the dang fence. That was later after he had was trying to run for re-election as a senator. But yeah, lots of villains in that story. Suderman, I'm going to let you answer the following question, which is that I'm giving you license to walk outside of your house, but you have to be triple masked and be wearing a Zardos diaper. Doesn't the Biden administration have at least some point in the following that, hey, look, you know, even if we decided tomorrow that the cap is 105,000, we've shut down all capability. Like all those offices got shut down under Trump and again through the coronavirus, so the combination of the both. Like it's tough to get the immigration engine back up and running when it's been neutered. You have to like build it up. It takes time.
I think there's some truth to but that is ultimately, you know, a delaying excuse. If they want to get it up and running, they can get it up and running, and they should. I think the larger point that I would make off of your question is that COVID has indeed made a huge difference in global immigration policy, because right now, borders are closed all over the world, and they are more closed than they have been probably in my lifetime, certainly since, I think, you know, the fall of the Soviet Union. And it's just, it's we are in an unprecedented situation where global travel was just basically shut down completely for a couple of months last year, and then has only been reopened in a very limited capacity right now, over the last couple of months or so. And there are Western, you know, countries that are talking about extending travel restrictions for another year or perhaps longer, even after their entire population is vaccinated. And I mean, there are, you know, officials in Australia who are saying that even if we have basically everyone vaccinated, we're not necessarily going to reopen our borders to international travel. It's just an absolutely awful situation. And the United States is part of that. It's not the only actor, obviously, but the free movement of people around the world is less free than it has been in decades right now. And a lot of that is because of pandemic era, pandemic power grabs.
Catherine, I'll have you continue the conversation on this in by way of responding to our listener question of the week. Reminder to everybody, you can email those to us at roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Daniel, who writes, I believe in letting all migrants across the border like a good libertarian. However, the cost of the welfare state, which is less likely to shrink than the universe itself, gives me pause. Catherine's response to this concern was to deny recent immigrants benefits. But denying benefits to largely minority immigrants is politically impossible, even for relatively short amounts of time. Taking that assertion as true, what should be my greater concern as a libertarian? Denying would-be immigrants citizenship or the ever-growing deficits? Catherine?
It's a good question, and I hate to respond to it by questioning the premise, but I think that some of those first sentences are worth interrogating a little bit. I ultimately think, though, that my baseline answer to that question is two wrongs do not make a right. The enormous growth of the welfare state is something of government period, but especially of the welfare state, is something that gives me huge amounts of anxiety. I think it is incredibly bad for our country. The restriction of free entry and free movement of people gives me huge amounts of anxiety, and I think it's incredibly bad for our country. Those are perceived as political trade-offs to some extent, but I don't think that the answer to either of those questions should depend on the other. So I do want to just sort of set that out. But then more specifically, I think, you know, we actually already do deny benefits to specific subsets of citizens and non-citizens all the time. So I think it's actually a little bit more politically viable than you're suggesting there. The ones that are the hardest to deny are things like public education to children. But those, luckily, are also ones that are most likely to pay off. If you come here and you bring your kids and you put them in school, sure, you haven't paid into the tax system yet to cover those costs, but your kids are going to stay here and work here and contribute to our tax base, most likely. Like, those benefits, I think, are the easiest to justify. And there are plenty of studies that show that that's the case, that, you know, people who stay, more than make up for any costs that they impose on the system, particularly in the second and third generation. You know, there's also just a vast and controversial body of work about whether, in the end, immigrants are a net drain on our welfare state as it is currently structured. You know, people who come here tend to be younger and healthier. They tend to want to work here. Now, you could say that pool would change in a truly open border system. Maybe people would come here seeking benefits. But right now, and even in a system where legal immigration was just substantially expanded, I don't think that that is the primary concern. I think mostly people come here and work and pay taxes and contribute to, you know, not just the federal balance sheet or the state balance sheet, but also to the growth of our economy. So I think I am very concerned about both of those things. I understand why many libertarians frame them as trade-offs, but I don't think that that's the right way to ask the question. I think we should let people in, and I think we should do everything we can to control the growth of the state. And I think that those two things, when they are occasionally in tension, could be reconciled with, for instance, just a time fuse on when you become eligible for Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. that's, I really don't think, morally beyond the pale, and something that if it facilitated an otherwise enormous good of letting particularly, again, refugees, asylees, or economic migrants who already have the wherewithal to start businesses to come here, then it would be worth it.
Let us shift to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Nick, why don't you start us off?
This was mostly in talking with my son, Jack, the other day, who watched the big Jake Paul versus Ben Askren video on demand pay-per-view event over the weekend. Jake Paul is arguably one of the most hated people on the planet, certainly in America, certainly online. And he fought, he's a YouTuber and just basic jerk who fought a former Olympian and mixed martial arts fighter in a boxing match, Ben Askren, and he knocked him out in the first round. I think everybody was disappointed in that. You know, people turn into, this is about the third time that Jake Paul has had some kind of celebrity boxing match. People tune into these things in order to watch him get beaten to a pulp. He's avoided that. It raised something like $75 million in pay-per-view. It was held in the stadium where the Atlanta Falcons play, mostly empty. It had Justin Bieber, the Black Keys, Doja Cat, Snoop Dogg, Mario Lopez hosting, the DJ Diplo. It is like a scene out of Idiocracy. And it is kind of wonderful and beautiful because, you know what, like, legacy media all over the place is falling apart because of its own rotten precepts, because of COVID, because of all sorts of stuff. And to me, looking at clips of this and following the commentary around it, it actually is incredibly exciting and energizing to see something like this get pulled off and become a major, major event at a time when people are afraid to go outside of their house, that you have a stadium not filled with people generating 70, you know, Super Bowl level kind of interest and activity, all voluntary, all awful, and all kind of wonderful.
Do you think it's going to be bigger or smaller than the Oscars ceremony, which is coming up next weekend?
Totally bigger and more meaningful. And also, this is part of a new kind of system that Snoop Dogg in particular is part of. They're going to have fights. They're going to have events like this. Bring it on. It's wonderful. It's a new 21st century form of kind of Roman gladiator spectacle, bread and circus, and it's all pay-per-view.
Are the the musical guests actually playing music?
Yeah.
Like, they're not just there.
Yes, the Black Keys and Justin Bieber and Doja Cat all performed. There were a couple of others, so it's like, you know, this is carnival, you know, whenever we need it.
Somehow that just made the whole thing just made my heart sink about the future. Why not? Peter, what
it's not Cal Jam 2, Matt Welch, but you know, those days are
not
past.
It's not Heavy Metal Day at the US Festival. Peter, what did you consume?
I have started playing Hitman 3, which is the latest in the Hitman video game franchise that has somehow or another been going on for like 21 years, I think, at this point. I think the first installment came out in, I want to say 2000, might be a little later or a little earlier than that. But it's a two-decade-old video game franchise in which you play a bald, genetically engineered assassin with a barcode tattooed on the back of his head, who, like, roams around levels. You know, it's an assassination game, but so there's a bunch of action and violence, but it's mostly about stealth and about getting from one location to another past guards and systems that are designed to keep you from moving to moving through the space. And so on the one hand, it sort of looks like a really violent action game, but what it actually is it's a puzzle game, and it's, right, because it's all about figuring out which costume you need, exactly how to traverse from one spot to another, how to move this thing here from here to there so that this guard can't see you, so that you're out of the line of sight, right? Sometimes you do have to take people down, but often it's sort of done in a stealthy way, and then you've got to figure out where to hide the body and how to do it quickly enough, you know, so that the chef who's coming back to his workstation doesn't see that you know, have choked his assistant and stuffed him into the into the freezer somewhere, and it's just a super clever and fascinatingly intricate system of geographic puzzles, where they have invented spaces that increasingly look and feel like real world spaces. So the first level of the latest installment is set at the top of a skyscraper in Dubai, right? And it's sort of meant to look like that giant thing that, you know, that giant building that Tom Cruise climbs up and down in Mission Impossible 4. I think they have like a different fake name for it, but it's the same idea. They're just stunningly rendered, and they're so complex, and they're so just sort of interesting to sort of figure out all these little systems and subsystems that the game designers have put into these worlds, and the ways that you can interact with them and play with them. It's just a great big sandbox. It's a puzzle sandbox that is really sort of wonderful for people who like puzzle style games. And I think I would actually sort of pitch this to people who, like, even if you're not interested in action games, if you're not interested in, you know, first person shooters and, like, you know, twitchy things where you've got just have to be much faster on the trigger finger than the 13-year-olds who are playing this game 11 hours a day. This is not that type of game at all. This is a thoughtful, game where you actually have to think through the scenarios and the way the world works and try to manipulate the world to sort of achieve a desired outcome. Also, it's really funny at times, and you can do some really funny stuff in it. There is a YouTuber who has been like seeing what you can accomplish in this game. And for example, one thing that you can do is you can kill everyone in one of these levels, every single person, and there's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, with a fish. And he's just like, yep, that's what I'm going to spend hours and hours and hours of my life doing, is killing everybody in this level with a fish, recording it, putting it on YouTube, and then like raking in the glory likes, right? And it's, I don't know, in some ways, it's like Nick was saying, it's sort of this like awful Idiocracy level, like what the hell is our society coming to? On the other hand, there's something like kind of wonderful about people taking these games and twisting them and like figuring out what the limits of them are and using them as platforms for kind of for like weird expression and absurdist, for absurdist expression. Right. And there's like this is what Monty Python is in 2021. It's not stand-up comedy. That's like kind of, you know, it's about silly pants. It's like, let's take a video game and kill everybody with a fish.
Catherine, I'm beginning to think that the trad cons are right. What's the weather like in your sandbox?
I am going to just ignore the insane way you phrased that question. And perhaps in an answer that will be pleasing to your trad cons, I read a children's Bible.
Yay!
But not that one.
I did not read that one.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. But I didn't actually read the actual Bible. I read a children's Bible, a novel by Lydia Millet. It is a really, really interesting book that my sort of genre that I keep being tempted by, even though I don't really want to read it, is like global warming apocalypse novels. And this is one. And the thing that's interesting about it, and Matt, perhaps a thing you would enjoy about this book if you read it, is that it is, everything in this book is an allusion to the Bible, but it's mixed. It's just allusions. It's not a metaphor. Like, it doesn't hold together. So, like, there's a baby.
That's, allusion, like, in the literary sense, not in, like, the magician's sense, right?
Allusion, yes. It's, like, there's a baby that's born in a manger, but then, like, that baby doesn't turn out to be Jesus in the story. It's just there's a baby that's born in a manger. Like, one twin brains another twin with a rock. We don't really hear much about that story afterward. And the thing that's interesting about it...
So it's like Into the Woods.
I was going to say, it's like the actual Bible. That actually, like, it's just this sort of series of strung together incidents and stories from which one could, if it felt important, spin a moral code, from which one could tell an origin story, from which one could try to build a set of societal rules. But it's not actually inherently there. Like, if you read Genesis, there's no rules for life in there, really, except for like, listen to God. Like when God gives you a direct commandment, you should do what he says. But that doesn't happen a lot, or at least it really shouldn't. And if it does, please check with your doctor. Anyway, a genuinely interesting read. Probably would be an even more interesting read for someone who wasn't raised as an absolutely semi-literate, godless heathen. Like, I did not read the Bible in any substantial way until I was well into adulthood. And so I don't have, I think, some of the deeper symbolic resonances or perhaps even just the literacy about some of the biblical passages and incidents that the book is referring to. Beautifully written, super compelling, super atmospheric. Also, there's just a layer over the whole thing of adults are bad, kids should only trust themselves. And very dark as a 40-year-old to read the book and realize that the bad adults who are just handling the apocalypse by drinking a lot are me. Like, I was like, yep, yep, that's not wrong. Yep, that's accurate.
Why is it a global warming novel? Like, what causes global warming in the context of the book?
Book is set in like a very near future where some of the predicted environmental catastrophes are coming due. So there's a flood. There are some plagues. That we understand in the context of the book that these things are happening because of the climate apocalypse, which is now upon us. But it's not, you know, it's how the climate apocalypse might indeed actually be, if you think such a thing will occur, which is that, like, it's a series of bad things that cause some of the things in society that we sort of rely on to break down, but not fully. Like, everyone's phones still work, even though all the coastal areas are getting kind of like really walloped by storms. And so power keeps going down and travel is more difficult. So it's a sort of, it reminds me a little bit of The Mandibles. Like, it's got a Lionel Shriver vibe to it, of it's like a realistic muddle through apocalypse.
I feel like after this presentation that I should just recommend Sohrab Ahmari's latest book, but I'm not going to do that because I don't have it and I haven't read it, and I'm not sure that I would recommend it in any situation. But my gosh, you people, turning me into a reactionary, listen to all your stuff. Tried to go to Coney Island Aquarium this weekend, but because we live in the new era of COVIDs and restrictions and metering and all this kind of stuff, it was just too many people. It was sold out. You have to do everything in advance. There's no spontaneity, man. I did.
That's where you got to play Hitman 3 and kill people with a fish.
I am not going to play video games as I am an adult.
You can watch the pay-per-view now, Matt. The Jake Paul fight is up there the whole evening.
I chose to take my 6-year-old to age-appropriate entertainment by Googling the word aquarium nearby New York. And there's one in Norwalk, Connecticut, the great town of Norwalk, Connecticut. They have a maritime aquarium and went there, and they have a 4D theater. I can only presume, and I didn't look it up, that this is just like a bunch of really bad, like, taxpayer money finance this whole thing, like, you know, waterside aquarium.
That is maritime museums in particular. Like, no one, there's no, I refuse to believe there is a privately funded maritime museum anywhere in this world.
I mean,
I refuse to believe it.
Even the one in Long Beach is pretty good, and Baltimore is pretty good. But yeah, I'm sure they're all boondoggles. So I went to the Maritime Aquarium, which is fine and great. But I'm singling out for recommendation the 4D theater. I have no idea what 4D means, but
the movie also has time.
The 4D theaters have environmental effects, right? And they basically spit at you or something. And like if there's like a helicopter on the screen, then like you feel the wind.
Seats moved.
Yeah, and I think the seats move a little bit. They're sort of like not quite full level simulators. It's not quite the Back to the Future ride.
It's like that terrible, what was the first one, Nick,
at
Disneyland when like Michael Jackson did a 3D, like
Captain EO.
Rainbow Party.
That was pure 3D, but then they have stuff like where they basically spritz water on you.
Yeah,
which is deeply disturbing.
We got the water spritz, like, so it's Ice Age, no time for nuts. obviously, from the animated whatever Ice Age thing came out like 15 years ago or something. And the story is very important. It's like 10 minutes long of some kind of squirrel or I don't know what, who's like really wants a nut. And then there's a time machine. Doesn't matter. None of it mattered. It was sitting in a theater with a 6-year old as there were bubbles and like snow and dinosaurs spitting at us. And I think it's probably the first time I've been in a movie theater in a year and change. So it was awesome. And they have another thing in the 4D theater involving sharks. I'm sure that's exciting too. Like Richard Dreyfuss will just come out and start singing Show Me the Way to Go Home or something at you. I don't know what. But really fun. I recommend it if you happen to be going by. I wouldn't recommend watching otherwise.
In the mid-1990s, there was a combination of like environmental effect 3D movie and stunt show that was a soft sequel to Terminator 2. So it was the T2 3D experience at Universal Studios. And actually, it was incredible, right? And so the stunt performers would be interacting with the 3D stuff on the screen, and then they would be like shooting fire at you and like blowing little ice chips and stuff when they blew up the T-1000 like for the 13th time. And James Cameron actually directed it, but it was like super delightful. And they actually got, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger to star in the movie, which was like a big deal at the time for him to be sort of part of this. Quite kind of unusual. Like, it wasn't a movie that you could just go see at a theater. I think you can now watch it on YouTube, although sadly without the live stunt performers or the fire.
I'm pretty sure you could probably get Arnold Schwarzenegger to show up at your house though for like 30 or 40 bucks
with his llama.
Is he going to bring his Conan sword and
his
llama?
Extra to get
his
him
miniature
to
pony.
Bring the pony. Yeah, we got to have the pony or else I'm not having it. It's not worth it without the pony.
That's all the miniature ponies we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you all for listening. Check out all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. And you'll be glad you did, to coin a phrase. We'll see you next Monday. Bye.